Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting live from the Santa Fe Baking Company on Cordova Road and streaming on the web at ksfr.org. Later on in the program, we're going to be speaking about linguistic human rights and endangered languages, and we're also going to be speaking about V-Day. The Vagina Monologues is coming to Santa Fe. Right now, I'd like to welcome Linda Siegel with today's legislative update. Welcome, Linda.
Good morning, Mary Charlotte.
So, things are getting hot at the legislature.
Yes, we have only 12 days left, and of course, many committees and both the Senate and floor chambers met this weekend. So things are picking up, and it'll be like this, and even worse, the pace will increase as we get closer and closer to the end on noon on the 17th.
What are some of the bills that you are following?
Well, I think one of the most important bills that happened this weekend is House Bill 2, and of course, that is the big state budget bill. It contains about $5.6 billion in all of our tax dollars and other revenue, and that House Bill 2 starts in the House, and over the weekend on Saturday, it passed out of the Senate. And now it will go back to the House for concurrence, and they won't concur, so the upshot is that several people from both chambers will meet in what's called a conference committee, and we've been hearing lots about those conference committees. That's the conference committee is that entity that there have been two votes on to try to open them up to public viewing. But, of course, both of those have failed. So this conference committee will work out the differences in the budget, and then both chambers will pass it, and the budget will go to the governor. Now, this is very unique because normally the budget doesn't go to the governor until, like, the last day or two of the session, but they're trying to get it up to him this week.
Very interesting. Why the difference?
Well, I think because the legislature wants to see what he's going to line item veto.
So that they want to override vetoes?
Well, who knows? But this way they can try to work out any differences they have because they'll still be in session. Normally when it goes to him the last day, then of course he doesn't have to sign it till 20 days later.
Now, have any bills actually already been passed and signed by the governor, or does the signing take place at the end?
No, a couple of bills have gone up there. It's kind of slow this session. Usually more bills have gone to the governor for signature, but not very many have gotten up there yet.
So what are some of the actual bills besides the budget that have taken action over the weekend?
Well, an important bill for property owners actually passed the Senate, and that's that surface rights bill. And what that deals with is right now those of us in New Mexico who own property, we mostly only own the surface rights. And somebody else, an oil or gas company, probably owns the mineral rights. And until this bill passes, if it passes through the whole legislature, they could just come in and set up their mining operation, and really you don't have any say over it. And this bill is a compromise that has been working on it for several years with the oil and gas people and citizens to reach some kind of compromise. So it sets up a structure so that you have to have notice if somebody's going to come in and mine on your property or put up a oil rig, and that you get compensation if it impedes upon the value of your property. So it's a really good bill, and one of those bills that having compromise coming into the legislature is much better than fighting it out in the legislature. So I think that one's going to go on.
What else have you been watching?
Well, today, up in the House, on the House floor, is the medical marijuana bill.
Uh-huh.
And this is its last step. If it passes today, it's going to the governor, and I believe he said he'll sign it.
And then there will be medical marijuana at Walgreens.
Well, not quite. And, of course, I think that you heard that the impeachment resolution is up in Senate Judiciary today.
Uh-huh.
So it's going to be a lively day at the Roundhouse.
Well, we look forward to hearing more about it on Wednesday. Linda Siegel is with us Monday, Wednesday, and Friday with the legislative update. Thanks so much for being here, Linda.
Thanks, Mary Charlotte.
We're going to take a little break and stay tuned to KSFR. I'd like now to welcome Dawn Wink. She's a writer and teacher, and she will be giving a public talk on linguistics, human rights, and endangered languages at 7 o'clock tomorrow, Tuesday the 6th of March at 1315 Luana Street for Penn New Mexico's Writers Roundtable. Welcome, Dawn, to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you, Mary Charlotte.
Linguistic human rights. Let's just talk about that term. What does that mean?
Basically, what linguistic human rights are every person's inherent right to speak their mother tongue, to speak their native language in whatever context that is. If people want to speak their native language out in public, if in schools, it's the inherent human right that people have to speak their native language.
Now, that is a construct that probably came up in the context of disappearing languages and the forced learning of new languages by whoever is colonizing or dominating a people.
Right.
How did you get into this whole field of study? Through what languages?
Well, I speak Spanish and German, and my undergraduate degree was in international relations, and I was always very interested in human rights. And later I went on and got into bilingual ed, and so those two passions kind of dovetailed into linguistic human rights.
And so what were some of the first actual cases that you observed of people trying to exercise their linguistic human rights?
Well, my first teaching position was as a bilingual teacher in a small rural town in California. And I started the first bilingual education program that the town had ever seen. And this was an area, all of the kids were the kids of migrant school work or migrant laborers. And they had been historically marginalized. I mean, they were still kids who, they were not allowed to speak Spanish on the playground. And I saw this, what the ramifications were, both socially and educationally. And it really, you know, to me, this whole idea of speaking on your mother tongue, it isn't a theory. It's letting Carlos speak to his mom in Spanish when he's on the playground. And so it really came home to me that this was not something abstract, that this is, you know, direct consequences. Our language is really our heart, our spirit, our history, our family. And so when people aren't allowed to express themselves, it affects all of that.
Now, what are bilingual education programs? Let's talk about the one that you set up. I think there's a lot of talk about that, then people not understanding what these programs are.
Right.
There's also a fear that if they're bilingual education programs, then people from other countries aren't going to learn English properly.
Right. Sure. And that's a great question, because it's very important to understand. When people say bilingual ed, there's a lot of different things that people mean. And what we know historically, what we know from research, is that the primary indicator for learning a second language, so the primary indicator for when people come to the United States learning English, is to be literate and fluent in their primary language. And so what the whole point of bilingual education programs, when they're properly done, and there are a lot out there that are not properly done, but the whole point is success in English, in addition to maintaining those ties with heritage and with their family. But it's not just that. We know that the best way for people to learn English is if they're literate in their primary language first, and then all of that translates over to English.
Now, when you have a bilingual education program in this country, it's primarily Spanish.
Right. There are lots of different languages. I mean, there's Chinese in San Francisco in the Bay Area. There's Korean. But most people do think of Spanish.
So it's you've made actually quite an interesting statement that success in English depends on their ability to speak and write their own languages fluently?
Exactly. Exactly. Which is why it seems kind of counterintuitive. We see kids who are born in the United States but come from homes where they speak other languages, they start kindergarten. And in general, those kids don't do as well academically as immigrant kids or immigrants who come to the United States who are already literate in their primary language. And we know that's the indicator for success. It's like when I went and
lived
in...
Why is that?
Well, because you only learn how to read and write once. And then all you, and then that translates to whatever language you're learning. So when I went to live in Mexico, all I had to do was learn the vocabulary, but I already knew how to read. And if you never, for the kids who are born here, a lot of times they're being taught how to read in a language they don't understand. And so what they need to do is be taught to read it in whatever their native language is, and it directly transfers over to English.
Now, my father, for example, his first mm-hmm. language was Sicilian. Mm-hmm. He didn't know a word of English until he hit school at age 6.
Right.
There was no bilingual education. He learned to read and write in English.
Right.
Learned only later to read and write in his native
mm-hmm.
language.
Mm-hmm.
And he got a PhD.
Yeah.
What's wrong with that model?
Well, there are people who that was possible, that they did do that. The vast majority of, like, when, because you hear my grandparents made it without bilingual ed, or what's wrong, why can't these people? The vast majority of people in that generation didn't go on to college and didn't go on to get a PhD. And so there were all of these wonderful economic opportunities that were open to people. They didn't have to be literate in English. They could speak in English, but it didn't prohibit them from doing well economically in the United States. Whereas now, with computers, with this dense literacy that you have to have in order to succeed, it's an entirely different world. You know?
But children are so absorbent at the age of 5, 6, mm-hmm, 7, 8, 9.
Mm-hmm,
they pick up languages so quickly, so easily. Why
right.
not pick up the foreign? Why wouldn't they? And they do pick up foreign languages.
What they do is, in general, where we run into problems is they pick up what we call social language. They pick up playground language. They sound very fluent in English, but there's this whole level which we call academic language underneath, and that's like the foundation for being able to read a textbook and understanding it, being able to take these abstract ideas and make meaning. And they're not necessarily able to do that in English. They can do all this social stuff. They sound very fluent, but it's they don't have the academic grounding and understanding that they need in order to succeed.
Now, in Santa Fe, one wonders if the native English speakers have that in our school system.
Well, I mean, I think, and then there's the whole social, native English speakers, it's the dominant language. I mean, they have all that sociocultural dominance that comes with speaking the primary language.
But the point is, I mean, let's say native Spanish-speaking kids mm-hmm. are not getting the academic grounding, maybe it's the school system who isn't teaching it to anybody properly. I mean, there's a lot of kids who get to the 9th grade who don't even know what grammar is.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I don't know. My kids are in the public school system here in Santa Fe, and I've been pleased with what their experiences have been as a whole. And so I think, I think that's really an individual thing. I think that comes down to individual kids, individual families. I know what you're saying.
Let's talk about, I mean, you wrote an interesting essay about your experience with Lakota language and Lakota
mm-hmm.
people.
Right.
Part of the, I mean, Spanish isn't going anywhere. Whether or not we have native bilingual education programs in the United States, mm-hmm. Spanish is spoken in many countries.
Mm-hmm.
But indigenous languages are really in danger, and that's
yes.
part of what you look at.
Right, yeah. Well, right now, indigenous languages are dying off faster than at any point in history. And at the rate that we're losing indigenous languages right now, within the next 100 years, 90% of indigenous languages will be gone. And so a lot of my work and what many people involved in linguistic human rights, it's trying to save these indigenous languages and not let them die.
And the reason for that is, I mean, it's when you read about the rate at which languages are dying, for all the world, it sounds like the rate of species going extinct.
Right. There's actually a correlation. It's interesting. This one writer who's very involved in linguistic human rights, Tove Skutnam Kangas, she has done a study where she has looked at the species, the variety of species of butterflies and birds in a specific area, and she's made those correlations as far as how many, the diversity of languages and the diversity of
species,
primarily butterflies and birds. And as one goes down, and she looked at the birds and the butterflies, there is almost a direct correlation with loss of variety of language. And so it is. They are going extinct in a very similar manner.
So how does that work? I mean, so you have people who are colonized. Colonizers tend to kill butterflies?
Well, a lot of what she has found is that as we lose forests, as we lose natural environments, that the species and the languages are absorbed in the dominant culture. And so in the United States it would be English. In the United States it would be these languages are all being absorbed by the dominant culture in English. She does a lot of research in like Southeast Asia and places where, you know, there are hundreds of languages being spoken.
We're talking to Dawn Wink, and she's going to be giving a talk on linguistic human rights and endangered languages at 7 o'clock tomorrow night at 1315 Luana Street for Penn, New Mexico's Writers Roundtable. What does the term heritage languages mean?
Heritage language is the language of your family of origin. So, for example, your father's heritage language would have been
Sicilian.
And so that's all it is. It's just it's basically your mother tongue.
And so the idea of preserving heritage languages for children so that they know their roots better is part of what this whole conversation's about.
It is. It is, but it's so much more also, because not only to know their roots, but for example, to be able to speak in a language that best captures the heart and soul with one's parents or with one's grandparents. For example, I speak Spanish fluently, but I speak when I'm talking to my kids, when I'm cuddling with my kids, I speak in English, because there's a connection there, there's an intimacy there that comes with one's native language. And so when that is lost, it's not just the language or the history, it's those familial connections, it's that intimacy and closeness.
So tell us more about your work. Let's get back to the Lakota example. It's interesting because in the essay that you wrote that I was reading last night, it talked about some Lakota people at a conference on languages that you went to said, gee, here come the white people telling us what to do again. We know perfectly well that our language is necessary to preserve, and now you're telling us how to do it. Screw
right.
you.
Right. Yeah. And that's one thing that I think it goes along with I'm Anglo, and I'm in this field of bilingual ed and indigenous languages, and people are justifiably circumspect because there's such a long history of people who look like me coming in and saying, this is what you need to do with your language. And for years and years, it was, do not speak this language to your kids, or speak English, don't promote this. I mean, historically they were corporally punished. And so there's of course a natural suspicion. And I know that, and I think that they have every right to feel that way. What I found is once we start talking, we realize we're philosophically in the same place.
Yeah, it was so interesting because this one of the people who was speaking about this was very angry about. I mean, you feel even just in reading your essay that there were 500 years of anger in all of his words about linguistics. And then at the end, you sort of went up to him and said, "Well, I'm a white girl. This is my passion. What do you think I should do?" And he said, keep doing what you're doing.
Yeah. And I think that's what my experience has been. Once we start talking, that's where it comes to. I think, you know, we all do what we can. And if we all contribute in the ways that we feel passionate about, that's all we can do. And now, I'm not going to not speak out just because I am Anglo.
Now, let's talk about Lakota in general. To what extent has Lakota language been lost? To what extent is it making a comeback?
Well, it's definitely a moribund language. And what that means is it is dying. And it is making a comeback. But presently, there are more people, more native speakers who are dying than there are people learning it. And so, but there are wonderful, passionate people who are very involved in setting up Lakota programs, in speaking Lakota. Now, you know, the kids are learning Lakota. And so, but it's still a very much an uphill battle. I mean, at the rate things are going, it'll still die off unless more people get involved and more kids learn Lakota. And there's very, you know, wonderful, passionate people who are looking to trying to get a Lakota immersion program going in the Black Hills and go, you know, but right now it's not there yet.
What is the realistic possibility of having people grow up and bilingually and then mm-hmm. pass that on to their children and have generations of bilingualism one after another?
Well, they do it all around the world. I mean, most places in the world, people are bilingual, trilingual. It's not thought of as anything unusual. But in the United States, we have a history of, I mean, we really kill languages faster than most other places on the planet. And people from other parts of the world look to us and wonder why we aren't bilingual, because it's the norm in most places. And, you know, you can't talk about this without talking about power, without talking about the power structure that goes with languages, and why the United States has so intentionally tried to kill off other languages and make the United States an English only.
And why do you think they have?
Well, I think language is power. And historically, indigenous languages, people knew that the primary way to colonize somebody was to cut off that ability to speak, that ability to think in their own language, that ability, and it scared them, because if somebody was speaking Lakota and I had no idea what they were saying, it was very, it was very intimidating to people. And so that was one of the first things they did, was to try to cut off that language.
English has become the lingua franca, so to speak, mm-hmm. around the world. It's the common language. Is that a good thing? Is it good to have a common language?
That, there's a whole other, there are many thinkers and writers who directly tie that to, they call it linguicism and linguistic imperialism, and they directly tie that to the loss of so much of the richness of these variety of languages. I think it'd be great if there were a lot more people who were bilingual. I think there's nothing wrong with having a common language. But we're pretty arrogant in the United States. We expect everybody around the world to learn English, and we don't need to learn these other languages. And not only learn them, but, you know, with a language goes a whole world view and a whole perspective. And to have a single, to not experience the world through these other languages and cultures creates a narrowness that I think we see in this country, that when one speaks another language, when one lives in another culture or sees the world through those views, you see the world through a variety of perspectives, and I think that's a good thing.
Well, We must, on that note, take off right now. I want to thank you so much for being with us. Dawn Wink is a writer and teacher, and she's giving a talk on linguistic human rights and endangered languages at 7 o'clock tomorrow, March 6th, at 1315 Luana Street, which is right off of Cerrillos Road, kind of across the street from the Smith Supermarket area, more or less. You can call 988-5185 for directions and more information, and this is part of the Penn New Mexico Writers Roundtable. I just have to say in closing, 6,000 to 7,000 languages on the planet Earth.
Right.
It really gives one a sense of humility because nobody can learn them all.
Right. Mm-hmm. And think about, in each of those languages, the richness of culture and way of looking at the world and way of understanding the world. And to lose that would create so much of a flatter plane of existence, in my opinion, whereas all those languages give depth and richness and multiple perspectives and understandings. And to lose that, we lose so much beauty and knowledge.
Dawn Wink, thanks for being with us.
Thanks so much for having me.
We're going to take a little break right now. Stay tuned to KSFR. V-Day is here. Ladies and gentlemen, I'd like to welcome Cecile Lipworth. She is Worldwide Campaign Director for V-Day, and Carol Kessler, who is the director of the Santa Fe performance of the Vagina Monologues, which will be this Thursday, March 8th. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
It's great to have you both. This is a very unusual piece of theater, the Vagina Monologues. It's by playwright, writer, activist Eve Ensler. Tell us about the nature of the play, how it came together.
Well, the play came together after Eve interviewed about 200 women. She had a friend who was speaking about her vagina and going through menopause, and Eve thought it would be interesting to interview some women about it. And after interviewing 200 women, she began to write the monologues and then perform them herself off Broadway for a number of years.
She did every part herself?
Yes, she did. Initially, she was the actress who did every part, as you do, off Broadway.
You do.
Are these are actual transcripts, pretty much, of the interviews that she did with people?
Pretty much. Some of the monologues are one woman's story, and some of them are sort of an amalgam of having interviewed women and then put their stories all into one monologue.
So it's not exactly documentary, but pretty close, as theater goes.
Pretty close, and I think that really is the success of the Vagina Monologues worldwide, is that every woman that ever has done it, from, you know, Croatia to Holland to Australia to America, identifies with some part of the play because it is women's real stories.
Now, this is being performed in Santa Fe, and you, Carol, are the director.
I am.
It's not one actress this time.
No.
It's many.
It's 35.
35. So how did you select those 35?
We held an audition in the middle of January, and I took every single woman that showed up, and I put her in a part.
Really?
And so that was kind of what Eve's philosophy is, that she wants everyone who really shows up and wants to be involved should be involved. And there were a couple that said, I really don't want to do performing, I'd like to work backstage, so I took their names, and they will help on the crew. But most of the women that showed up are dying to be in this, and so I found a way to put them in.
Now, are these people mostly people who have acted before?
No. Well, it's a mixture. There was a woman that came to our last rehearsal Saturday, said, you know, this is the first time I will ever have done this in front of people or done anything like this, but she's wonderful.
What is it like for you to direct non-actors and actors together?
I ran a community theater in Española for 5 years, and it was non-actors mostly, so I'm used to this. And I just love the light that goes off in their eye when they're participating in something that they never thought they could do.
Now, are you, when you cast people for each little part, each little monologue, did you make choices based on?
Oh, sure. No, and because there are some monologues that really one woman will do, and it needed to be an actor, a strong woman who really could get the most out of the monologue. And then there are group ones. I've split some of them up into six, so it's like a chorus. And there, they just feed off each other. It's wonderful to watch.
Are some of the monologues ensemble pieces where there's more than one person speaking together?
Yes. Uh-huh.
I guess there's a lot of flexibility with this play and how
very,
it's directed.
It's very much like that. And I think you just, it's kind of up to me to visualize it, which as a director, I've done a lot of this, so I can sort of visualize how it'll work. But it really, it lends itself to great flexibility also.
And so how much rehearsal have you done?
We had 3 meetings after the initial auditions, and one Saturday just to sort of hone and sort of make tight some of the monologues that needed to be tightened a little bit. But it's really like that. And
you just have you have the whole ensemble of 35 show up.
Yeah, and just do a run through. And they have they put their monologues on little cards, so that's what they'll read from. It's not memorized, which is great, because that takes the pressure off, too.
One thing that we talk about with a lot of theater people who come in here is there's this moment in rehearsal, somewhere between the first rehearsal and the opening night, where the magic kicks in.
Yeah.
Has that happened?
Saturday, because with all those women, we had been really doing run-throughs, and I could see people were excited. But Saturday, actually, having them have the ownership of these monologues now, saying, add a line to it or add a word to it, you could see that they really, now they feel these monologues are theirs. And that really did happen Saturday.
So the Vagina Monologues is being performed on Thursday at 8 o'clock. That's the 8th of March at the James Head Little Theater, right here in Santa Fe. Now, Cecile Lipworth, what is V-Day? It's not just one day.
No, it isn't. V-Day is actually a global movement to end violence against women and girls. And when Eve first began V-Day in 1998, there was one performance in New York, and that happened on February 14th, which was Valentine's Day, but also Victory Over Violence Day for V-Day. And with the growth of V-Day going from one performance in New York to this year, 1,150 communities around the world and college campuses are doing V-Day events, which are benefit performances. With that, we've extended the time frame from February 1st to March 8th, which is International Women's Day. So V-Day is a movement, a global movement to end violence, and it's also a day where we fight for violence to end.
So you are the worldwide campaign director for V-Day. That sounds like a big job.
That is, rather.
What do you do?
Well, as I just said, there's 1,150 V-Day events that take place globally, which in 45 countries.
Now, is the event always the performance?
The event is always the performance, but what happens is each community or college campus that does it raises funds and awareness about local violence locally in their community. And so it really brings the whole dialogue into the community to open up and talk about what goes on in their community or what goes on their college campus. My role as the director is to sort of be a guide and an assistant to all these events that are happening around the world. And we prepare a huge kit for them every summer that they download off our website. They work from that. And so my role is really to give guidance and to help and assist wherever they need it.
It's interesting how this has taken off cross-culturally. Were the original interviews that Eve Ensler did with women from all over the world, or were they mostly Americans, Europeans?
They were with women initially started in the U.S. because that's where she was, but the scope of women that she interviewed was all races, Caucasian, Hispanic, African-American, lesbian women, straight women. They were really cross all sort of boundaries, so to speak. But as Eve has traveled the world, and she's been to over 40 countries in the last 10 years, she has interviewed many more women. Particularly, actually, one of the monologues is an interview with the Bosnian women, which she had been to before she even began the Vagina Monologue. She had written another book called Necessary Targets, another play, I should say. And so the one of the monologues is an interview with Bosnian women who were raped during the war. So it is cross-cultural and, as I said, cross all nationalities and races.
War is visible, it's in the news. Violence against women is not so visible and not so much in the news. What's going on there?
We'd like to know the same thing. This year, actually, our theme is reclaiming peace. And one of the things we are concentrating on or spotlighting is women in conflict zones, because war exponentially increases the risk of violence towards women. And you're right, people don't concentrate on that. It's not sort of the sexy part of war to think about how women are being abused, both during times of war and then what happens to women after war, how they have to rebuild the society. They're the ones rebuilding the family life, the community life. So it isn't something that is spoken about. And I think it's a big issue that a lot of people are trying to get out into the public, what's going on in Rwanda, what happened in Rwanda, what's going on in Darfur, what's going on in the Congo. I mean, people need to wake up and pay attention to what happened to war, women during wartime.
There's also a lot that happens to women during peacetime, even in a place like Santa Fe, which is on the surface a fairly tranquil place.
Well, actually, one of the taglines that we brought into Santa Fe V-Day is bringing peace into your home, your community, and the world, because V-Day's stance is really that if a government allows war to happen and perpetrates war, well, it gives license to people in their own homes to perpetrate violence, because there's no sort of, there's no sort of limit to it if your government says that. So,
is that a real correlation in violent, in countries that are perpetrating war, there's more domestic violence?
I certainly couldn't be an authority on saying the statistics are there, but I think that just philosophically it allows people to think that if you can go and bomb and kill someone and occupy someone else, then why can't you do it in your home and do that to the people in your home? It gives license to that. I certainly think that, but I couldn't be an authority.
I mean, the one example like that I know is true is that where there are laws against hate crimes, there aren't as many of those hate crimes, and when those laws are repealed, people feel that there's license, or when they're not passed, people feel that there's license to commit, say, a crime against a gay man or whatever.
Exactly. And I think, I also think that, globally right now, the world is just so at odds. There's so much going on, violence. And I think that the escalation, or perhaps it's just that women are coming out to tell their story more about what's going on to women, is very powerful and something we really should be paying attention to.
We're talking to Cecile Lipworth and Carol Kessler. Cecile is the Worldwide Campaign Director for V-Day, and Carol Kessler is the Director of the Santa Fe Performance of the Vagina Monologues, which is happening this Thursday at 8 o'clock at the James A. Little Theater. You were recently at an event in California honoring women from conflict zones.
Yeah, we were. We had an event during Oscar week. It was a pre-Oscar event that we really wanted to bring to the attention of the women in Hollywood, because there's a lot of powerful women in Hollywood. The issue of violence of women in conflict zone and what happens to women in war. And so we held an event and we brought three women who we work with, one from Afghanistan, from RAWA, the Revolutionary Association for Women of Afghanistan, and a young woman of 20 years old who was a survivor of the war in Sierra Leone. At 13, she had been abducted and forced into sexual slavery for the rebel war warriors. And a woman from Haiti, who a long-forgotten country of where there is enormous violence and huge epidemic of rape against the women there. And the three women came and told their stories, their personal stories, as well as the stories of what their countries are going through right now. And it was very, very powerful. And we hope that the women in Hollywood, we'll take that back, and we'll continue to do this annually. We're hoping to keep the emotion and the topic alive in Hollywood with these women who can really make a difference. They can really financially help and get the word out through film and hopefully in the media.
There are so many very well-known women, especially actresses, Jane Fonda, Glenn Close, writer Erica Jong. I'm just looking at Julie Kavner, all these women who are involved directly in V-Day in one way or another. It's just such an almost surrealistic contrast between these Hollywood you know, wealthy, famous, you know, living a comfortable life women and these women from conflict zones?
There is, but the really interesting thing is I've been at a lot of VIDA events where there have been celebrities, and one of the things Eve often does at an event is she asks people at the end in the environment of being safe within the community, you know, in their community, to stand up if they've ever been violated. And I was at Madison Square Gardens in 2001 where we had 70 celebrity women, and the thing is that a lot of the women stood up having been violated themselves. So the story is in conflict zones, but the story of women being abused, it transcends class lines, and so I think they can relate because some of them have faced abuse in their own lives, and so they understand what it's like, perhaps, to be raped or to be, you know, domestically violated in their homes.
Carol Kessler, what's it like for you? I mean, I assume you'd seen the Vagina Monologues before.
No, I'd never seen it.
Oh, this is the first time
first
you've worked
time
with this
and never
material.
Read it. Yes, and it's powerful. And in a way, I'm glad I hadn't seen it, because you have preconceived notions if you see another performance, or if you see I know the productions that have come to Santa Fe, the three or four, however many, have been all with celebrities. And when you see someone do it.
Yeah, I saw Maureen McCormick playing one of the roles. She was Marsha Brady.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Doing unbelievable sexual acting on stage. It was quite something. But
no, I'm glad to come to it. Just as when I do theater, I never try to, if someone has done a part that I'm planning to do, I don't want to see how anyone else has ever done it. I want to bring a fresh eyes to it.
That's interesting. Is that a something that you do in directing in general? In other words, if you're directing Shakespeare, you don't look at other...
Uh-uh.
Interesting.
It's my vision. It's what I want to bring to it. And it may be wrong, but it's my vision.
So being immersed in this material must have been, besides an artistic, also kind of an emotional experience for you. Because, I've only seen the play once, but
It was just amazing. And when I first read it, it was kind of shocking the first time I read it. I thought, oh, my goodness, we're going to have women say these things. Now it's like saying vagina is just such a wonderful... That's a word I never, ever... I just didn't come up in my vocabulary before. But now it's just one... And some of the women this weekend said the same thing. They said, vagina is such a beautiful word. And, you know, now I feel like I can just say it. And it just doesn't make me uncomfortable.
Although, etymologically, it does mean sheath, the place you put your sword. But never mind, ladies and gentlemen.
Thank you for that, Mary Charlotte.
Yeah,
you're welcome. Among other things, I want to let people know that the recipients of the funds raised from the production and other associated activities of V-Day this year will go to the Santa Fe Rape Crisis and Trauma Treatment Center, and the Esperanza Shelter for Battered Families, and the Female Genital Mutilation Fund in Africa, or the Fund to End FGM in Africa. Tell us about these places and these causes.
Well, it was really important as a local community production to give back to the community, and we wanted to honor the women who do the work every single day of helping women who've been abused or running away from abusive situations. And so both the Rape Crisis Center, the Rape Crisis and Trauma Treatment Center, and Esperanza Shelter do incredible work in Santa Fe on, you know, struggling to raise funds continuously to keep their programs running, to keep women safe. And we really wanted to honor them and to help contribute to that fundraising effort. And then the FGM Fund in Africa is something that Sally Blakemore, who is sort of one of the co-creators of this event in Santa Fe, wanted strongly to contribute to, because she had been to the conference to end FGM in Africa last year, and then she and I went again this year together. And it's something that is really... that you can actually, by helping these young women, which seems like it's a cultural thing and we shouldn't get involved, but in actual fact, they are running away from their homes, not wanting to be cut. These young girls are 12 and 13. And so to help them financially, we'd like to contribute to giving them an education, to giving them protection and safety in a safe house where they can then reconcile with their parents and be both the parents and the children can be educated about the effects of FGM and why they shouldn't be cutting the young girls. So that's the
We've done programs on this. It really is a form of torture with ramifications like infection, death, bleeding, inability to bear children, reduction of all sexual pleasure.
At this conference, which we were at in January, you know, there were sort of 30 women and a few men. And almost every single one of the women themselves had been cut when they were young girls. And just their stories of the pain of childbirth, of what it does in just giving birth to their children. And, you know, some of them have 3-4 children. And I couldn't imagine the pain of that. And then some of them living in countries where there's war and then having been raped after they've been mutilated. I mean, just the effects of that are really horrific.
And puts one's own problems in perspective.
Definitely.
The V-Day, in the many years that it's been going, has raised untold millions of dollars. It's been a very, very successful effort.
Yeah, communities and college campuses since 1998 have raised $40 million locally, which has stayed in their communities. And you know, on some college campuses, they've started women's programs. They've started buddy systems of walking women to and from class, you know, evening classes. Communities like in Kenya, in Nairobi, the V-Day there kept a rape crisis center open for another year just by the funds that they raised. So they definitely, the funding has really helped in all the communities.
It's so interesting because there are so many causes, people doing incredible work that make a difference in individual people's lives. Your vision is much greater than that. It's making institutional changes. It's actually changing the way societies work.
Yeah.
Any luck on that so far?
Well, we kind of like to think that we are. I mean, Eve's vision, and she really is someone who is an extraordinary visionary and is very passionate. I mean, Eve's vision is to end violence against women. She honestly doesn't really want to see the creation of more, you know, more rape crisis centers and more service. She wants to rather see how we stop the violence completely. And really what it is women are the primary resource of the planet. And the more we desecrate them, the more we desecrate the whole world and the planet as it is and the generations to come. And if we could protect women, just protect them, imagine what those women could do if they weren't having to deal with violence and every day go to work, you know, having been battered at home or raped or abused. Imagine the power and the strength that those women could have and what they could accomplish without having to feel bad about themselves.
Are there places where you've seen, let's say, a town or a city or even a college campus has actually been changed by this work?
Actually, we have been doing some work with a group in Iceland, which is an incredible group of women and men who came together to do V-Day 5 years ago. And one of the things they have is a festival every year in September where it's sort of kind of like a music and, you know, festival where there's music and drinking and eating, and it's a great sort of outdoor event just before winter comes. And in the first when they began doing V-Days, they studied this, that there were a lot of young women who were reporting rape at this festival, and they decided to do a national campaign. Now, Iceland's not a very big country. There's 250,000 people in the whole country, but they did a national campaign on radio and posters and on TV. And last year they reported to us that this was the first time that there had not been any reported rapes at this festival. And they did some really strong, powerful messaging around it. So I like to think that that's a reason and a positive thing, because they've actually tracked something that's happened. And there are communities and campuses. Now, of course, off the top of my head, I can't really think of any other ones. But there are where we've seen incredible responses to the performance being done for a number of years. And it's not just the performance, it's the dialogue that goes along with it, especially on college campuses where they do a lot of panel discussions and they open classroom discussions and they really talk about the issue, not just about vaginas, but about what it means to really say the word and own it and not be afraid of it.
What's it like for you, Cecile? You've probably seen the performance in so many different versions, time after time. What's the experience like of repeated exposures to the performance?
Every single time is a new time. You know, I saw it in Juarez with the cast, the Mexico City cast, and it was entirely in Spanish. I don't understand a word of Spanish, unfortunately, but I knew from the faces and the expressions of the women exactly what they were saying. It's a phenomenal thing, and every time there's a new a monologue that says something else to me and something different to me. It is an incredible and an unbelievable and sort of an unexplainable phenomenon when you see the play of what it really does to you internally.
And what was the audience reaction like in Mexico City?
Oh, it was phenomenal. It was we did a march in Juarez to highlight the murders that had happened in Juarez. And everyone was invited to this free performance where there were these professional actors from Mexico City. And it was it was just uproarious. People were screaming and shouting and clapping, and it was phenomenal. It was really a phenomenal experience.
Now, I'd like to just emphasize, this is a play for women and men both.
Absolutely. In fact, one of the really interesting things is that a lot of men come to the show, and then afterwards their reaction is, wow, I really didn't know that was happening. Wow, I've never thought about it in that way. I've never put it into a context of this or of how it affects women in general, how violence affects women. And so it really is important. And if we're to stop violence, we do need to include men in the conversation and the dialogue. And so we encourage men to come.
Carol Kessler, who are some of the people who our audience members might know who are in the play?
Oh, Patty Boucher.
City Councilor Patty Boucher.
Yes. Yeah, she's doing, actually she is doing a piece on Juarez. And she picked that. We a few people, we asked them, what would you like to do? And that was the one. And Honey Harris is doing an amazing monologue. And I won't even say anything more. You just have to see it to believe
That's
it.
That's right, because perhaps some of the words cannot be said on the air according to FCC regulation.
That's right.
The wonderful Honey Harris, who used to sit in this very seat. Well, Cecile Lipworth and Carol Kessler, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you
so much for having us, Mary Charlotte.
And once again, the Vagina Monologues is at the James A. Little Theater this Thursday, the 8th of March, at the James A. Little Theater at 8 o'clock. And for tickets, you can call 988-1234. You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We are on the web at ksfr.org. Check out our wonderful website. You can reach me at the email radiocafe@ksfr.org or leave a message at 428-1528. Thanks to Dr. Hubris for engineering today. Stay tuned for the BBC, followed by local news by KSFR's award-winning news team, and after that, the colors of jazz. Broadcasting live from the Santa Fe Baking Company, my name is Mary Charlotte. We'll see you in the morning tomorrow. Bye.